Good morning, Your Honors. Patrick Summers, and also with me is Julie Nagorski, representing the appellants, Talon First Trust LLC and Talon OP LP. May it please the court. Your Honor, first like to address the appeal of the court's $2.5 million award of a late fee.
Excuse me, Jason, you want to hit the clock? Thank you. Go ahead.
Your Honor. And I'd like to start with a quote from the Gorco construction case, 99 Northwest 2nd, 69, a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1959 dealing with liquidated damages clauses. And in that case, the court stated, in determining the issue, neither the intention of the parties nor their expression of intention is the governing factor. The controlling factor, rather than intent, is whether the amount agreed upon is reasonable or unreasonable in the light of the contract as a whole, the nature of the damages contemplated, and the surrounding circumstances. The law adopts as its guiding principles that the injured party is entitled to receive a fair equivalent for the actual damages necessarily resulting from the failure to perform the contract, and no more. Punishment of a promisor for breach without regard to the extent of the harm that he has caused is an unjust and unnecessary remedy and is a provision having an impact that is punitive rather than compensatory will not be enforced. The issue of the court's award of this $2.5 million late charge is subject to de novo review by this court. And we argue, Your Honor, that this late fee is in fact a punitive penalty and a windfall to Respondent Gamma.
So which case you cited now, quoted to us, Gorco, which of the Minnesota cases do you think best exemplify your side of the analysis and resulted in the appellate court determining that a liquidated damages provision in a Minnesota case was in fact an invalid penalty?
Well, Your Honor, I think the analysis in the Gorco case is a good one in terms of looking at the relevant elements. I think the court's emphasis on Minnesota case is certainly telling here, and I echo that, in that this appears to be an issue of first impression. I was not able to locate a case which permitted such a large late charge to be applied to a balloon.
And I'm curious that you say that it's a case of first impression, and yet relying on Gorco, which did look at a liquidated damages provision, didn't it?
It did.
It just didn't strike it down, as a penalty.
Correct. And I would say, in regards to my comment about an issue of first impression, certainly the Minnesota courts have analyzed many liquidated damages provisions and determined whether they're a penalty or not a penalty. It's more specific to, and I think it's relevant that the specific facts here, we have such a large penalty, which under the loan documents and under the court's holding, hit immediately after there was a default. There was no
The penalty hit, and it's large. I don't think anybody's going to quibble with you about that. You could have calculated it, though, on the date that the contract was signed, right?
Well, and that's one of the problems with this, it being a liquidated damages provision. Those damages were subject to
It's been
to
a problem in some courts, and you point that out in your brief. I realize that, but in terms of some other factors that a court will look at in evaluating the validity of any contract provision, one of them is, you know, as you, I think, already characterized, the contract as a whole and the circumstances under which the contract is executed. So these are sophisticated parties. They were represented at the time that the contract was signed. And I don't see any argument either in the district court from your side, district court or on appeal, as to there being some inequality of bargaining position or something that would suggest that your client didn't go into this with eyes wide open. And that's what I would like you to comment on.
And I'm not arguing that these are sophisticated parties. I'm rather stating that it was the potential damages that could result as a result of a breach on the payment of the balloon payment. Those were damages that could have been calculated fairly readily at the time that the loan documents were executed. I mean, this is a commercial loan, sophisticated parties, and they in fact provided for protections within the loan documents. We have.
But you saw your client signed the document. And you certainly respect that in Minnesota, we tend to, depending on the circumstances that the courts are presented with, but where the parties have freely entered into the terms of a contract, that contract is typically enforced, which I think underlies a lot of the district court's analysis in this case.
And I don't disagree with what the court says in terms of generally contractual provisions. Courts will look at it and enforce them unless there is some other public policy or other reason to not apply that or enforce that. And in regards to a liquidated damages provision, that is something where the court looks at it de novo and determines whether, in fact, this was a permissible and will, in fact, take that decision out of the parties and decide as a matter of law, was this a proper and appropriate liquidated damages provision or was it punitive and in the nature of a penalty?
Well, you're certainly right. The question of law is there. And that's why my first question started with a Minnesota case in which the appellate courts have struck down a liquidated damages provision as a penalty.
Well,
and so given that we haven't had that recognition in Minnesota of a public policy reason driving an invalidation of a provision, and I'm not talking about a late fee. It wouldn't have to be a late fee provision. It could be something else.
Well, I think it matters the specific facts.
Where am I going to look to for case law in Minnesota that would say public policy, again, analogized to the facts of this case, public policy supports striking down the late fee in this
case? Well, I
case.
Think that's where I know the court's looking for Minnesota case site, but I think—
I prefer that. I mean, I realize that you have some excellent cases from outside Minnesota. I've read them. The problem I see with them is they are relying heavily on case law that is quite different from Minnesota, and in particular, different restatements.
And can I—I just want to—
Yeah, no, go right ahead.
Have you comment on this? So I know that there was a New York choice of law provision in the contract, but it seems, is that right?
It does contain that, but there's some discussion whether Minnesota or New York law would apply.
Everyone seems to agree that New York and Minnesota law are very similar.
That appears to be generally the case.
And both of these states, ours and New York, are still sticking with Restatement 1 of contracts?
That appears to be generally the case.
And some of the cases that you cite in support of your argument from other states have adopted Restatement 2 of contracts.
Which I don't know, and I'll certainly defer to the court's analysis on that in terms of how material that difference is.
I was going to ask if you think that's material or not.
I don't think so, and I would also note, kind of teeing off of Your Honor's commentary about Minnesota versus other states, that the underlying district court opinion contains a lot of citations to other states.
Yeah,
other
and don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that you have no position in this court because you can't point me to a Minnesota appellate court decision that has struck down a liquidated damages provision as a penalty. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I was asking you for is it seemed to me you were moving heavily in the direction of public policy, that was the reason why this court should strike it down. And I'm really looking to you for when has Minnesota done that, under what circumstances, and how does that help your position? So I'm looking for help from you, honestly.
I just want to touch a little bit on some of the facts here that I think are relevant to that analysis. Okay. And that is the fact that the underlying loan documents they cover the types of damages or expenses that Gamma is complaining they could have suffered as a result of a breach. For example, the default rate of interest. The interest rate was a market rate, and then it jumped up to market plus to cover the additional expenses or damages due to lost use of the funds or other potential exposure to about $26,000 a day for that default rate of interest. In terms of attorney time and costs, as an attorney's fee provision. In terms of other expenses for running incurred due to the conditions of the building and the like, those are also covered in some extent in the loan documents. It also provides for the appointment of a receiver, and in fact a receiver was ultimately appointed.
But what Gamma talks about that I don't see in your briefing addressing is the internal time it spent addressing property-related issues that were unaccounted for in the loan documents, as well as the loss of goodwill and reputation. And I didn't see that you addressed those concerns.
And Your Honor, that's a fair question. And I would note, our position, that's covered into that default rate of interest. I mean, this is a regular.
That's lumped into that?
Lumped into that. In addition, that's just, the ordinary course of being a lender, that you've got certain general kind of overhead expenses that are incurred at administrating a loan, and at the time that you're executing the loan documents, that's something that could be calculated. And I think in terms of, the other parts of the analysis that the Minnesota courts have looked at is, can we reasonably, at the time that they executed the contract, was it possible to figure out about what the damages would be at the time of a potential breach? And I think in a commercial loan like this, that is something that's calculable. I
mean, how do you do that with the loss of goodwill and reputation?
Well,
I mean, that's typically stymied courts when they've looked at it in the past.
Well, and I mean, I don't know how they could establish what that would be in any fashion, and I don't know that there would be any loss of goodwill and whatnot in the terms of lenders lend money. Sometimes, generally, it's paid back, and sometimes there's a default, and I don't know. We're getting kind of in more of a factual analysis, which I think might be outside the scope of a motion for summary judgment in terms of establishing that. But I don't think it affects the ability of the parties at the time they entered into the contract to figure that out. And I think, the other jurisdictions that have looked at this specific analysis, they look at that and they've considered those types of expenses and have found them generally, in the cases cited in our brief, to not reach the threshold to find such a clause not to be an unlawful penalty. And I note in terms of factually that there was a receiver appointed and the receiver collected the rents as they're entitled to do, and those rents have covered the various expenses and damages claimed by Gamma. And that's looking at the two-part test that they need to satisfy, that need to fit here, is whether, one, the fixed amount is a reasonable forecast of just compensation for the harm caused by the breach, and two, whether that harm is incapable or very difficult of accurate estimation. And certainly those are the issues we've been talking about with Your Honors. And I note in terms of other items of potential damage, there was some indication about insurance costs, and while that was something else that was also, the court looked at it, and that's a mathematical exercise. I mean, it, as is evident in the complaint and the documents filed by Gamma, it's a loan. It's something that one can calculate quite clearly as to what damages and costs and whatnot would be incurred, and judgment was entered in favor of Gamma for all of those amounts. They proceeded to foreclosure, and they foreclosed upon the property. The $2.5 million is simply a windfall to Gamma on top of what has already been determined by the court to be an appropriate level of damages based upon the loan documents.
If we were to publish this case, what would the syllabus point be?
The syllabus point be?
What would the rule of law be?
Well, I think the rule of law is simply just recitation of what the standard is and what the test is in Minnesota for determining whether a clause is a liquidated damages clause or a penalty clause. I don't know. There are some it's a fairly fact-intensive analysis, so I don't know. I certainly can't comment whether this is a publishable or non-publishable case, but in terms of the rule of law on it, I think it's simply, under the specific facts and circumstances in this case, running the analysis as required under Gorko and other subsequent cases, was determined here that, in fact, this was an unlawful penalty rather than a proper liquidated damages clause.
Could I just, we only have 1 minute left of your time. Could we talk about the attorney's fees for just a moment? You challenged the amount that was awarded.
Yes.
Do you agree that our standard of review is abuse of discretion?
I do, Your Honor.
You disagree with what the district court did, but in what respect? It looks to me like the district court went through it and individually thought through the various claims. In what respect do you claim that the district court abused its discretion in making those awards?
Frankly, Your Honor, I think a $145,000 fee award in a case such as this, a foreclosure action for 35 days of work is excessive.
Just the total number, not any of the individual entries.
Well, certainly on the individual entries, I'm not going to go through chapter and verse.
Well,
I know
we don't have time for that, but
yeah.
The district court did that. Your argument is simply that the conclusion that it reached was an abuse of discretion.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, yep. No, and I touch on some of the specifics in the briefing, and I'll rely on that, Your Honor.
Very well.
See that I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you want to use that time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Respondent, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Knapp. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, Gamma Omega Lending, LLC. And, Your Honors, I'd like to start by saying I think that the opening line of questions really hit the nail on the head here. This is a valid contractual loan provision that Talon is trying to avoid. This 5% late charge at issue, it was negotiated in good faith by the parties. Each were represented by counsel, and each had decades of borrowing and lending experience. So to now avoid this obligation over 2 years later, Talon had the burden to introduce some evidence that would demonstrate that this late charge at issue is grossly disproportionate to Gamma's actual damages. And Talon hasn't done that. They've only offered speculation, conclusory allegations, and illegitimate comparisons. And this is not sufficient to overcome the presumed validity of this late charge.
Well, why aren't the two provisions redundant? That is the default interest that jumped up so much and the liquidated damages.
Well, I think that's really the heart of the issue, Your Honor. I think that what Talon does is they identify certain buckets of damages. They identify the $52 million principal, they identify the collection costs, and they identify the default interest, the default interest. Those buckets of damages don't encompass the entire universe of the damages that Gamma has suffered here. And those damages include things that the court's already touched on, things like loss of goodwill, internal administrative costs for administrating this property and becoming the de facto property owner, cost of repair, cost of maintenance, cost of taxes. Those items aren't covered by the default interest or any of the other buckets that I mentioned. So what the parties did at the outset of this contract is they had to make a forecast, a reasonable estimate of what those charges would be. And what the parties agreed to was that this 5% late charge is a reasonable estimate of what those damages would be. And I should also add that I think that that's a really accurate estimate.
So this is the part that I struggle with a bit with your argument. You say it's a reasonable estimate of the damages, and yet it's the 5% late charge isn't really an estimate. As I asked, appellant's counsel, it's a pretty fixed number at the time that the contract was signed.
It's a guess. Yeah, it's a reasonable forecast.
It's a guess maybe of the damages, but it's almost a fixed number at the time that the contract was signed, wasn't it? I mean, it's pretty clear that you can pretty much compute the number, right, when the contract is signed, assuming there's a late payment.
Right, you can compute the number, that's correct. Yeah. You can compute the late charge. What you can't compute is the anticipated damages, and that's what the court has to look at. It has to look at whether the late charge is grossly disproportionate to the anticipated damages, and the anticipated damages.
And which case do you rely on for that test?
That's the Gorko test as well. So.
So you agree with appellant's counsel, at least on that point? That
I think Gorko is very instructive. Sure. And to your point earlier, Your Honor, about cases in Minnesota that have addressed this liquidated damages charge, there's a host of cases that have upheld a liquidated damages charge in Minnesota, and specifically late fees. We cite those in our brief. Those include... There's the Schindler elevator case, there's the 606 Vandalia case, there's the Winthrop Resources case, there's the In Bowles case, and And those are Minnesota cases. We talked about the conflict of law issue a little bit, too. There's a host of New York cases that also support that.
And would you respond to Judge Riley's questions about conflict of law? I mean, that's obviously not an issue that's troubled the parties. You appear to agree on what the contract says, as well as the fact that it doesn't matter whether Minnesota or New York law is applied.
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. There's no conflict of law analysis that's necessary here because under both Minnesota and New York, these late charges are presumed to be valid. There's a presumption of validity in both jurisdictions. They're enforceable so long as there's a reasonable relationship between the late fee and the anticipated damages. And there's a host of New York cases if the court wants to look at those. The most recent case is this case called JMD Holding. And what the court did in that decision is it really focused on the sophistication of the parties, the intent of the parties, and it viewed those earlier cases that Talon cited as, in my view, antiquated. And I'd like to quote just briefly from a case that JMD relies on. It says that absent some statement of fraud, exploitive overreaching, or unconscionable conduct to exploit a technical breach, there is no warrant in either law or equity for a court to refuse enforcement of the agreement of the parties. And I think that's exactly what we have here. There's no fraud. There's no unconscionable conduct. What the parties did here is at the outset of the agreement, they agreed on what the late charge would be. This was something that was negotiated. Talon agreed to it. Now it just doesn't want to pay it.
The late charge was incurred in its entirety as soon as there was a late payment, right?
That's correct.
So even if one day after the late payment they had refinanced, they would have had to pay $2,586,000.
Yeah, and that's a fair point, Your Honor. And I think that that's a different case. So maybe they would have some claim for, you know, unconscionable conduct to exploit a technical breach, but that's not what Gamma anticipated here, and that's what the court should look at. It should look at what the parties anticipated at the outset of the contract.
If I understood the facts right, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems as though the Talon in this case notified Gamma fairly quickly that they were not going to make the payment, right?
Right.
And it wasn't the scenario that, the other hypothetical scenario of someone who is a day late and says, I think we can come up with the money, give us a few more days, something along those lines. It was the opposite. Do I have those facts right, or am I wrong about
That's correct. And $52 million isn't easy to come by.
Well, no, I appreciate that, too. But I'm just, in terms of understanding what, if we do try to clarify a rule of law, this is not the case where someone who owes money says, give me a few more days, I can make the payment.
Yeah, so with this case, Your Honors, this is a very large loan. It's $52 million. It's secured by unique property. When the parties were negotiating this contract 2 years ago, what Gamma anticipated is that if they didn't pay on day 5 or day 6, they wouldn't pay on day 7 or day 8. They would have to undergo a lengthy foreclosure process, a lengthy receivership process, and incur all of these expenses, such as maintaining the property, paying expenses, paying taxes, paying insurance. And, Your Honors, that's exactly what happened. What Gamma anticipated happening in the event of default has actually happened. They've had to undergo this foreclosure proceeding for over a year. It's over now. They own the property, but they're still incurring these costs and expenses that the late charge was intended to compensate for.
Which is outside the record as to what's happened since.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. But I think the court can take judicial notice of the fact that the property was foreclosed and the redemption period ended on, I think it was a few weeks ago at the end of December. Your Honor, just to briefly to delve back into the law quickly. Sure.
So I asked Mr. Summers if we were to publish what the syllabus point would be, and he's not sure we should publish because it's so fact-specific. Maybe you agree with that. If so, say so. Otherwise, what do you think the syllabus point should be?
You know, I believe the syllabus point should echo the existing law. And the existing law is that these contractual provisions are presumed valid. they're especially presumed valid when they were entered into by two very sophisticated parties, as we have here. And if one party challenges it, that party has the burden of producing some evidence to show that the late charge is grossly disproportionate to the other party's anticipated damages. And I don't think they can possibly do that here. I think the district court got it right. These late charges are reasonable. And I think that should be the syllabus point. And I think there's a host of law that already is on point in both Minnesota and New York that says that.
Thank you.
And Your Honor, again, looking at the relevant circumstances here, there's no doubt that the trial court got it right and that these late charges are reasonable. This case, again, involves a high-risk loan. It was a one-year loan on a $52 million loan secured by a unique piece of property here in downtown St. Paul. Given the size of the loan, the term, and the nature of the secured property, Gamma recognized that there would be no quick fix if there was a default. So in addition to those other remedies that Talon identifies in their brief and that we've talked about in terms of the buckets of damages, Gamma insisted as a condition of this loan that this 5% late charge be included, and that's what the parties agreed to. That's what they agreed to it because it was intended to cover things like loss of goodwill, the administrative costs of becoming a property owner, all of the expenses of repairing and maintaining and potentially trying to resell this property. There's an elevator in the building that needed repair. There was a $330,000 bill that Gamma had to pay. It had to write a check for $330,000. That comes out of the late fee. The parties could not have anticipated that Gamma would have had to write $330,000 check during the foreclosure. So it's these types of things that are really unknown at the outset of the agreement that these late charges are intended to compensate for. And unless Your Honors have any other questions on the late fee, I'd like to move on to the attorney's fees portion very briefly.
Please.
As the court mentioned and as counsel acknowledged, the standard of review on the attorney's fee issue is abuse of discretion. Here, Talon hasn't pointed to any abuse of discretion or error by the district court judge. Talon simply disagrees with the decision and thinks it was too high. In awarding the late fees, the district court had firsthand knowledge of everything that was done. It had knowledge of the work.
The attorney fees, you mean?
The attorney's fees, of the work that was performed, the complexity of the case, the services performed by counsel, the billing records, and so on. And here, Judge Castro was in the best decision to make a determination on whether or not those fees are reasonable by looking at the things that are required to be looked at under the Minnesota case law, and those include things like experience and ability of counsel, the fees customarily charged in these cases, the amount involved, the results obtained, and so on. And this court need look no further than Judge Castro's order. You can tell that it's very detailed, it's thorough, it's thoughtful, it's meticulous. He went through hour by hour and dollar by dollar to determine what's reasonable and what's not. In fact, Judge Castro even discounted our fees or disallowed 10% of our fees in doing so. And I would also, as a final point, I would also like to add that Talon played a large part in driving up these fees. You know, what should have been a uncomplicated case, which...
In terms of the receivership appointment.
Exactly, the receivership appointment and other matters. What should have been an uncomplicated case and a straightforward receivership and foreclosure, Talon fought Gamma every step of the way and had a considerable role in driving up those costs. And for these reasons, Your Honor, we believe that the district court did get it right and that these attorney's fees were, in fact, reasonable. And so we would ask the court affirm both the late fee issue and the attorney's fee issue.
Thank you. Appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time.
Thank you, Your Honors. I wanted to return to one of the initial questions. And the Gorco construction case, the court did actually invalidate the clause. And so I think I kind of returned to the Gorco case. It also had the Supreme Court in that case did touch on the issue of, you know, modern trends and supporting clauses. In fact, the court stated in there, and this is at 481, the modern trend is to look with candor, if not with favor, upon a contract provision for liquidated damages when entered into deliberately between parties who have a quality of opportunity for understanding and insisting upon their rights, since an amicable adjustment in advance of difficult issues saves the time of courts, juries, parties, and witnesses, and reduces the delay, uncertainty, and expense of litigation. So here's the Minnesota Supreme Court basically concurring, why are we meddling with this? We have sophisticated parties, they knew what they were doing, they signed it, and yet the court fairly immediately after that holding or statement on the current case of law when this was issued, overturns the provisions, remands it, the provision finds that it's a penalty and remands for trial. So it's, I say what it's clear in Minnesota that courts have a duty and to take a hard look at these clauses and determine under the court's analysis whether it is will be enforced or not. And Minnesota courts do take that decision of whether it's a liquidated damages or not, not at the face value of what it states in the contract, but what the court determines based upon its analysis under the tests that we've been discussing and have been extensively briefed. In regards to the attorney's fees, I'll just briefly note that the time frame at issue here is about 35 days, and it's a snapshot of what was occurring there. And there was some appropriate opposition to the appointment of a receiver. There was certainly no finding by the court that any conduct by the appellants drove up the costs unnecessarily or, you know, increased the expense.
There was no assessment of, like, bad faith attorney fees, but he was determining the actual attorney fees.
Correct, Your Honor, but just in response to counsel's argument that there was conduct, that the cost would have been lower but for conduct of the borrower in the underlying case, Your Honor. And in terms of, you know, the kind of commentary of prior cases being antiquated or whatnot, I would assert that the court, even back in 1959 when Gorco was being was decided, looked at the same considerations in terms of whether we enforce or not enforce parties' contracts, and, you know, made an independent analysis based upon the facts of that case, and found that the liquidated damages provision was in fact a penalty. And I would argue, Your Honors, that under the facts and the circumstances in this present case, that the court erred as a matter of law and asked that the award of this $2.5 million late fee be reversed, Your Honors. Unless the court has any follow-up questions.
It appears we have none. Thank you. We appreciate the briefing and argument from both of counsel. The matter is submitted, and we'll issue our decision within 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.